Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Boston wants to join nearly a dozen other cities and towns in a pilot that would allow them to ban oil and gas in some new construction. Earlier this month, Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker signed a major climate change bill into law that's meant to bring the state closer to its goal of net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. And that includes that pilot for 10 communities. Baker said it, quote, gave him agita, end quote. WBUR climate reporter Miriam Wasser is here to help us understand the pilot, what that could mean for all cities and towns. Miriam, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So just first, what is this pilot program? How does it work? Who qualifies?
Yep. So there are slots for 10 cities and towns. And to participate, the municipalities need to have at least 10% of their housing stock be deemed affordable. It's not totally clear how each city or town will institute the ban. They might phase it in over a short amount of time. Another might say, like, bam, this is the new rule. And that flexibility and leeway was sort of by design, right? So this is a pilot program. It's a real-time experiment into what happens when we build all-electric homes. In terms of timing, we don't quite know yet. The Department of Energy Resources is still in the process of figuring out what metrics it will use to decide which towns can partake and not. And they have until next July to figure this out. So nothing's happening tomorrow.
All right. And that's really helpful because in some of the reporting and conversations, we hear this regular list of cities and towns mentioned, but they haven't officially been chosen yet, right?
Yeah. So those are the cities and towns that have the list you're seeing is usually the cities and towns that have expressed an interest in doing that.
Brookline,
and
then with Newton, Aquinnah.
Yeah, Lexington, things like that. And then oftentimes you see a secondary list that says, like, within that, these are the towns that meet that affordable housing metric. But no one's been selected yet.
So to that point, Brookline was kind of an instigator in all of this.
Yeah, yeah. Back in 2019, Brookline became one of the first towns in the country, I think. Definitely one of the first to vote to ban fossil fuels and new construction or big renovations. Attorney General Amora Healy said that wasn't legal under state law, so that never happened. But it's legal now under the law. So Brookline is probably going to be one of those towns.
And do you feel like you can draw a line between what Brookline did and to the bill that Baker signed?
I mean, yeah. I mean, other towns have also done or also expressed interest in doing this. Other towns across the country have also expressed doing this. But yeah, within the Massachusetts context, I think Brookline was the first and probably the instigator.
So that list had been out there, but now mid-August, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu says Boston should be a part of this. Here she is talking about joining the pilot.
Our city is ready to join this pilot program to understand and lay out how banning new fossil fuel hookups can benefit our cities, our state, and our country.
So, you know, feeling like there's a little bit of elbowing going on, and yet we don't know. So is there any clarity? Like, are cities and towns pretty sure, okay, we're going to have to do X, Y, and Z and prepping now for that? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think it's going to come down to what the Department of Energy Resources decides and how they're going to measure these things. But I will say it will be a huge deal if Boston does this. It will be a huge story nationwide, but also, right, the whole goal of this is to get us data and information about what happens when we build all electric, because this is the future. Like, we need to cut building emissions. And so figuring out how that works in a smaller, more affluent town and also in a big, diverse city like Boston is going to get us the information we need to design these building codes for the future.
All right. So we are talking about a 10-city Massachusetts pilot program that's up ahead of us to ban fossil fuel hookups in some new construction. Miriam Wasser, WBUR senior reporter, has just been giving us the lay of the land. Miriam, sit tight. We've got two other people here in the studio with us. I'm going to bring those voices in now. Lisa Cunningham is a residential architect and co-founder of Zero Carbon MA, and Henry Celli is an associate principal with CBT Architects in Boston. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Henry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So Lisa, I'll start with you because you're pretty enthusiastic about this. So tell us why.
Well, we really have to stop building with fossil fuels. We've known for decades that we have a climate crisis of unmitigated proportions. And so we've been told by the most conservative energy agencies in the world, the UN International Panel on Climate Change and the International Energy Agency, that we have to stop burning fossil fuels immediately. So it's critical that we stop burning stuff. It's also critical that we stop making capital expenditures on equipment that burns stuff. So the state is currently allowing us to put harmful gas systems in our homes and in our new buildings, and they wouldn't allow us to, for example, put lead paint in our homes. They wouldn't allow us to put asbestos in our homes.
So,
and they've got to, basically, we've got to get gas out of our homes and our buildings.
So that raises an interesting point. And Miriam, I'm going to pivot to you here on this. So Lisa, the first part of your argument was about the climate impacts, but asbestos, lead, that's toxicity. So Miriam, we were talking about this before the show. Where are we in our understanding of the harm, like, I like my gas stove. I have one in my kitchen. Where are we in our understanding about the harmfulness of gas in homes?
Yeah, and I was saying to you, like, I'd be careful while you're cooking.
You
or
did
maybe
say
open,
that to me.
Open a window. It seems like every new study that comes out is just telling us more and more about the dangers of having fossil fuels in our home. As Lisa said, gas stoves in particular, we know that when you burn the gas, there's a lot of harmful things that come out of that. It's been linked to asthma. It's been linked to cancer. It's bad. Also, another recent study that WBUR reported on a couple of weeks ago was looking at what leaks out of gas stoves even when they're not on. So, I mean, we know these things are bad for your health.
So there is this both and here. Henry, I'm going to turn to you, and I'm going to play a little bit of sound because I'm going to just bring you right in with a two-part question. I'm going to make it harder for you. So I'm going to play a little sound here from Chad Ellington, who is the lead of Peak Development Group. And he was in a recent Time Magazine feature about a fossil fuel-free community in Colorado. Here's a little bit of his sound. This is about 3 months ago.
If everyone could live in a net zero home and it would be cost effective to do so, we would obviously all do that. That would be awesome. And I think we'll get there someday. It's just not there yet.
So it sounds like what he's arguing, Henry, is that it's not cost effective to do this yet. Is that your experience?
I would say that it really depends on where you draw the circle, meaning if you're going to look at what the cost savings are with designing and building a really efficient building, there's benefits to that over some time, right? So the life cycle analysis, which is a trend that we're seeing a lot.
The energy will be less expensive and have less climate impact over time.
And you're using a lot less of it, right? So you're spending a lot less of that for the operation of the building. So I would say that, you know, for multifamily type projects that I work on a lot in office buildings, we are seeing that we can actually get there pretty quickly, especially on the multifamily side, I would say. Lisa and I have been talking a little bit. I think on the life sciences type of projects, it's probably a little bit more difficult.
Like a lab or something like
that. That's right. On a single family home, and Lisa has more experience on the single family side than I do, but I would say that's not a stretch to get us to a net zero building, frankly.
So we're here in studio with Miriam Wasser from here at WBUR, Lisa Cunningham of Zero Carbon MA, and Henry Celli, who's an associate principal at CBT Architects. Lisa, we're talking about this pilot, 10 cities, that's coming to ban fossil fuel hookups in some new construction. You basically said, listen, this is coming. And so I think what I'm hearing you say is at least let's start by not building anything new that we then have to undo or fix. Is that right?
Absolutely. So the state has a goal of a mandated goal of reducing their carbon emissions by 50% in the next 8 years. That's by 2030. That's also our federal goal. So we have to reduce our carbon emissions in every sector, including our building sector. And right now we're going in the wrong direction. And so
what does that mean? What do you mean we're going in the wrong direction?
Well, we're continuing to build new fossil fuel infrastructure that we know that we're going to need to rip out almost immediately. The state has got a goal of actually decarbonizing, taking out the fossil fuel infrastructure of 1 million homes by 2030 and 300 to 400 million square feet of commercial space. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, the state is continuing to allow us to install brand new fossil fuel infrastructure that we know is going to last for up to 30 years. So that just doesn't make any fiscal sense. So this doesn't make any fiscal sense. We know that gas prices are extremely volatile. We know that we've got an incredibly old and leaky gas infrastructure that's going to have to be repaired to the tune of $40 billion, which is also going to hit ratepayers. So this is a fiscally irresponsible. And we need to. We also need to look at the health aspect. As Tiziana was saying, 1 in 8 children in Massachusetts have asthma. This figure is greater in EJ communities,
environmental justice communities.
Thank you,
Miriam. You've been here talking about before with us here on
Absolutely.
Our show.
Absolutely,
yeah, Lisa. Yeah, and so it's really a fiscal imperative. It's a health imperative. It's a climate imperative, and it's an imperative to protect our most vulnerable populations.
So a couple of things I want to pick up on there. And of course, I said, Henry, I was going to ask you a compound question, then only ask you the first part. So here was the second part. I'm going to come back over here. Sometimes I distract myself with how interesting the conversation is. What about the design aspect? And I don't ask that to minimize what Lisa was just saying, but you're also a craftsperson. You're an architect. And is there, like, are you excited about this from a design standpoint?
We are, absolutely. It really forces us to think about how we're designing. On the architectural side, right, our focus is more on when it comes to energy, it's more on the envelope. We really want to figure out.
What does envelope mean?
The facade of the building, the roof, foundation.
Well, literally the outside.
That's right.
It's like efficiency stuff.
There we go.
What's keeping the cold or the hot out of the building? so that's mostly our focus, right? And we have our consultants and engineers who are working on the systems. But it does excite us because we have to be really creative about it, not just the aesthetic that we're trying to develop, but how do we actually develop a facade that's actually going to be much more efficient than what we traditionally would build.
And this kind of gives a mandate to do that.
It does. And there's actually now building codes that are actually forcing us to do the same thing.
And can we learn enough? I mean, we have multiple types of buildings in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Residential, multifamily, single family are an important kind, but they're a subset. Can we learn enough from a pilot of that kind of construction in 10 cities and towns to extrapolate the way we would need to for broader public policy from your perspective as an
Absolutely.
Architect?
I'm not even sure it needs the 10 cities, but I think with just a few buildings itself, we can learn quite a bit.
And, Lisa,
and we're learning that now, frankly.
And Lisa, can I jump in really quick?
Just one thing I should have mentioned before. The pilot program does not apply to laboratories, to life sciences buildings, and healthcare facilities. So there are exemptions built in for some of these harder to decarbonize and buildings that use a lot of power.
Yeah, that's fair. And Lisa, you agree that it will learn plenty from this subset?
I think we already know enough, quite frankly, and that's why these bylaws have passed overwhelmingly in the communities that they've passed in. I mean, we in our bylaw in Brookline, we passed by a vote of 213-3. We had similar votes in every other community that has passed these home rule petitions, and we've just last week, Somerville announced that they had passed a home rule petition, so they are also in the line, and communities will continue to pass this legislation because we cannot meet our climate goals without stopping to build with fossil fuels.
So, Miriam, then why did Governor Baker say it gave him agita?
I think he was primarily concerned that it was going to work against some of our efforts to build much-needed housing, especially affordable housing in the state. And, you know, that's a really big issue. We need more.
Because of cost and supply?
Yeah, I think cost was the major factor. Also, concerns that developers might not be interested in developing in certain areas because they'd have to abide by these rules. They'd rather build elsewhere. And he was concerned that we share the need to build housing across communities as well, and worried that if a more affluent community instituted this sort of ban, that they would then they wouldn't have the same amount of development, let's
say. It would
say.
Make it hard to build multifamily and more affordable housing. Henry, you want to jump in there?
Yeah. I think one interesting thing about that is that we're actually seeing a lot of affordable housing in the state of New York that's actually using passive house strategies to build their affordable housing because they recognize how much less energy those buildings actually use. So in the long run, it's actually a much more efficient building for them. So, you know, something to think about, but
so it does raise, and Lisa, I'll turn to you on this. you know, a lot of the communities that we're talking about are either affluent, as Miriam has noted, or in the eastern half of the state. So I'm thinking about a community like Athol, Massachusetts. We had an author here who was born and raised in Athol recently. We were talking about that community. Or another western Massachusetts community, let's say. Is this geared toward, I mean, what about embracing this across the state? What about more rural communities with different energy needs, et cetera?
Well, this is being embraced throughout the state. This movement, we first passed our bylaw in 2019 in Brookline. So that was, as you recall, right before the pandemic hit. So it was the affluent communities that went first. But now, as you're seeing with Boston, Somerville, there are other EJ communities in the pipeline that want to pass this legislation. So, I mean, this really is an equity issue because, to Henry's point, that affordable housing is actually leading the way in Massachusetts. In the town of Brookline, our Brookline Housing Authority was the first to come forward and support us. All our 40Bs in Brookline,
which have, is affordable housing.
Affordable housing, thank you,
yep.
are being built to passive house standard and all electric. So this is already being done in Massachusetts. It's already mainstream. And, you know, low-income communities should have the same ability to have clean and healthy buildings that my wealthy clients do. So I think this is something that EJ communities are hopping in line to pass and is just going to become very mainstream.
So turning back to you, Miriam Wasser, who's our senior reporter on climate here at WBUR, what about the grid? I mean, we've had you on recently talking about electric vehicles as well. Mm-hmm. So we're ramping up all of this demand for electricity. What about the grid? And what about when the power goes out?
Well, I think that those are two separate questions. So,
oh, yeah, on, fair enough.
on the grid side, I would say, like, yeah, there are people who are working right now to figure out how we're going to meet the electric demand that we're in the process of creating. And I think we'll have more clarity on that in coming months. I mean, we're going to have to build a lot of new renewable energy, and we're going to have to build a lot of new transmission lines to bring the power where it's needed. But those processes are underway. To your second point, you had asked me earlier, you know, what if I'm like, it's the middle of January.
All electric house, right.
Yeah, I'm about to cook dinner. I mean, power outages are inconvenient, but if your lights go out right now, you make do. You light a candle, maybe.
Well, yeah, but what if your heat is electric, et cetera? We've had communities that are out of power 3, 4, 5 days at a time in a bad storm. Henry's nodding over there. Henry, do you want to help Miriam?
Yeah, heat is
it?
A different thing. Go for it, Henry.
Yeah, because I would say, you know, now that we're actually building incredibly efficient homes and buildings, the need for heat for those 2 or 3 days is actually a lot less.
Oh,
right. So it's a resilient point of view where the, you know, if the power does go out, the envelope is so efficient that you're actually not losing all that much energy. I mean, 4 or 5 days, sure, that could be a problem, but.
Okay, you bent my brain there a little bit. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Actually, all right. Yeah. So back to you, Miriam. What are you watching for on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how the state develops these criteria for who gets to participate. We have a new governor coming to office in a few months. That person will have a lot of say probably over how this goes, and we'll see what other cities and towns across the Commonwealth raise their hand and say, I want to try this too.
Well, WBUR senior reporter Miriam Wasser, CBT architect, associate principal Henry Celli, and Zero Carbon MA co-founder Lisa Cunningham. Really informative. Thank you to all three of you for coming in.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Let's talk for a second about a pretty widely depicted stereotype. The stereotype of the overbearing Asian American parent pressuring a son or daughter to excel academically. You can find that trope everywhere. Books, TV shows, movies. Here's a bit of actress Sandra Oh as Ming Lee, the overprotective mom featured in Pixar's 2022 film Turning Red.
What if I come with you?
What
are you doing? Linear equations? Geometry? I have a double jointed elbow. Look! I can make a perfect circle.
Wow. Yeah, but it'll be super boring. Wouldn't you rather hang with Dad?
Let's get my flashcards.
I do love Sandra Oh. But as it turns out, of course, the real picture is so much more complex. And Natasha Waraku, sociology professor at Tufts University, set out to paint this more complex picture of both white and Asian parents in her new book, Race at the Top, Asian Americans and Whites in Pursuit of the American Dream in Suburban Schools. I've read the book. It will make you feel something. And Natasha is here with us. Welcome back, Natasha.
Tiziana, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited to have you because I have so many questions after reading the book. But we should start. We should let listeners catch up with us. So the premise of the book, you spent basically 3 years embedded in an unnamed or renamed affluent East Coast suburban town. You called it Woodcrest, to study white parents and Asian American parents, how they fight to support their kids and what that fight does to the community. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
And when you set out, did you say, I want to go embed myself someplace for 3 years because I have this question? I mean, how'd you get here?
So, you know, I was really interested in, I've always been interested in racial inequality and education. And I've become more interested in kind of privileged communities and how inequality kind of gets produced in them. And I was noticing these two trends about Asian Americans. One is that just the great explosion of Asian Americans in the United States. The Asian American population has nearly doubled in the last two decades, and we see it in the media, stars like Sandra Oh. I mean, that's a big deal. There was almost nobody who looked like me when I was growing up in the United States in the media. And so you have this explosion, and then there's a parallel thing that kind of kept coming up over and over again, which is Asian American academic achievement. So, the winners of the spelling bee are almost always Indian American. And, the average SAT scores of Asian Americans are higher than, even than whites. And, the sort of big numbers at some of the most elite colleges. And so I was noticing these two trends and I noticed some tensions around them, the most prominent one being this Harvard lawsuit.
But the affirmative action. Yeah.
Sorry, yeah. And just, it starts appearing in the headlines. And so I wanted to kind of find a community where these two trends were. I'm a qualitative researcher, so I wanted to go into a community where these two trends were happening. So I looked around at towns, and there are towns like this all over the country, where it's a suburban, well-off town with a large and growing Asian American population. And in many of these places, if not most, Asian Americans are doing quite well and even maybe slightly better than their white peers academically. Now, everybody's doing well. So, these are very advantaged communities with high levels of education. And I wanted to see kind of what ensues in those kinds of places.
So how come I'm sorry, you're hearing a pause because like 10 questions are in my head at once. We don't have probably have time for all 10 of them. And there's so much I want to know. All right, let me back up for a second. Because one of the things that is important, I think, for listeners to understand and didn't fully come out there, and I want to bring out, is you really interrogate not only the culture of Asian and Asian American parenting towards education and achievement in this falsely named community Woodcrest, right? But also white culture and how what these two groups in the community, they're doubling down on their cultural approaches means. And I'd love to have you draw that out for people to understand that a little bit better.
Sure. Yeah. I always like to look at groups in comparison to one another. One thing that I did notice, and I was hearing it again in that clip that you played, was that there's that stereotype of the, quote unquote, tiger mom among Asian Americans. But there's also a parallel stereotype among kind of white upper middle class moms, this kind of helicopter parent idea. And so trying to understand what's different about these communities, what's similar and different, was what I really wanted to understand. And the thing that I noticed as I kind of dug into this and, observed the kids, talked to parents, spent time at the school, high school, was that, it was almost like, all parents, and I think this is across class lines, racial lines, we all want to do whatever we can to help our kids get ahead. But we do different things because we have different skills. We're exposed to different ideas. We live in different neighborhoods. We have different economic resources, of course. And what I found was that the Asian parents in this community, most of them were immigrants, and they were mostly highly skilled immigrants with high levels of education, just like every other adult in this town, because that's what it took to be able to afford to live in a place like this. And so so they had done well academically in India and China, mostly. These were mostly parents from India and China. And what does it take to do well in those education systems? You got to be good at educational testing. That's what's going to get you into a top college. And that's, you know, going to those colleges, what's going to get you into graduate school.
Well, you said in the book that it is the thing, basically the only thing that gets you in.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's no attention to extracurriculars or anything else you're doing, teacher recommendations, none of that. It's just the exam. And, you know, the parents get that it's different in the U.S., but they really, what they know is how to do well on academics. And that's what they impart to their children. They do things when their children are young. Many send them to, like, extracurricular math classes. You know, they, in high school, they really push their kids to take as many as honors classes as possible. And, you know, if sports or theater gets in the way, they kind of pressure and they ask their kids and suggest to their kids that they quit those activities. And sometimes the kids listen, sometimes they don't. But the focus is really on the academics. Take as much academics and do as well as on them as possible. And everything else is sort of icing on the cake.
Whereas the white families,
go ahead.
Sorry. No, I was just...
I tend to go on and on. So the white parents are different, right? So they grew up in, you know, an education system in which many of them had gone to very selective colleges in the United States. And, you know, many of your listeners will know that in order to get those colleges, you have to be strong in academics, but you also need to be well-rounded. They're not just looking at your academics. They're also looking at your extracurriculars and, you know, your letters of recommendation. And so those parents, you know, said had the opposite message that, you got to do well academically and I'm going to get you a tutor if you need it to do, you know, get an A, you know, get a decent grade in your classes. But they, you know, they said things like, you know, we told our kids you can only take one honors class in a year because you're going to be really busy with your sports because you're doing club this year or you're doing two varsity sports this year or three, or you're going to be in theater when it's production time, you're going to be living at the theater. And so there was a sort of recognition that, all these parents realize there's only so many hours in the day and we don't want our kids being so overscheduled. So, but the white parents were more likely to say, let's, you know, not go crazy with the academics so that we can make room for intensive extracurriculars as well. And that's the biggest difference I saw.
So I want to, and I'm going to actually say to you, I have so many questions. So the next question I ask you, I'm going to ask you to give me a nice tight answer on it so I can keep going. I do want you to highlight one of the things that you talk about is the fact that your sense is that from being embedded is that the white families are trying to move the playing field, that we know because of systemic racism, that the school systems, bias, et cetera, are set up to favor white students. And that originally academic excellence was the playing ground. And you're essentially arguing that the playing field is moving as we go. Is that right?
I think so. Yeah. And it's not a deliberate, like, we're going to do this so that our kids can remain ahead. I think it's much more subtle and unconscious. It's this, you know, sense of like, you know, like there was all this debate about children's emotional well-being, you know, that the town really cared about and was worried about this. And so what do? So the solution that many of the white parents came up with and that was most often heard in school board meetings among the school board administrators was to sort of attenuate the academics. So the school had already stopped naming. Yeah, less homework was a big thing when I was there. There was a debate. They ended homework and the elementary schools made rules about when teachers could assign homework in the high school. And, you know, and as a way to sort of attenuate stress. And some of the Asian parents were like, you know, well, my kids aren't stressed because they're not doing activities till 9 p.m. and then have to come home and do their homework. So why are you, you know, every family should basically decide for themselves.
Or whose stress are we attenuating?
Yeah. And, you know, why can't we have intramural sports so my kids can, you know, have an outlet but not have to go every day? So they had different solutions to how to deal with this problem.
So I found the book fascinating. I spent a lot of time trying to guess what community it was. Are you ever going to tell people who it actually was?
That's always the first question people ask. I think what I would say is that if it sounds familiar, it's because there are many communities like this around the country.
That's a pretty good dodge. So, I'm going to tell you my guess, just for the record, my guess after lots of thinking it through and looking at the demographics, et cetera, my guess is Lexington, just for the record, but I have no idea if I'm right. What I do want to ask you is I was struck in the book, and we're speaking with Natasha Waraku, who's a Tufts University sociology professor, new book, Race at the Top, Asian Americans and Whites in the Pursuit of the American Dream in Suburban Schools. You were reflective. You talked about your own discomfort. Wait a minute, how should I feel about my own parenting? I'm glad that my kids are in a less competitive school district. You also talked about your own experience with Asian identity and how that made you feel about both the Asian and Asian American families and the white families. What journey did you go on?
Yeah. So, my parents are from India, and I was born and grew up in the United States. Very different kind of place, small town in Pennsylvania. It was pretty easy to get A's and, go back, be done at 3 o'clock after school. But so, on the one hand, I think having grown up in an Indian family really helped me understand some of the Asian parents and their concerns and their perspective. I remember my dad, this was horrific to like a kid, keep saying, I'm going to go to the school board meeting and complaining that I had to go to band practice for so many hours after school. And why didn't they have like a math club instead? Why I should be doing that many hours. And so I have a lot of, I didn't as a child, but as an adult, I have empathy for that perspective. And I kind of understand where they're coming from. And on the other hand, I grew up in the United States. I went to college in the United States. And I also understand, I think I'm a very different kind of parent than my parents. And I also see this sort of, and I feel this desire for my kids to not feel like they have to do all the academics and to find, an extracurricular thing that they love. It's sort of, you pick up on that. And so I think I have this unique vantage point. It's not why I set out to do the study, but I think in the end it helped me. And there were moments definitely in this study where I think I talk in the book this one time when, I went home after doing, spending some time in the field, and I came home and I was like, oh my gosh, my kids need to do some more math. And I looked up these classes. I looked up the Russian School of Math classes. And I was like, oh my gosh, they're 2 hours a week and then they're going to have to do homework. And I was like, I don't think I'm going to be able to, my kids have too much autonomy and too much, like, it's not the culture we've created in our household. And I didn't even bother to ask them. Maybe I asked them for a second, do you think you'd want to do this? Okay, no. All right, next. Drive you to soccer.
So, I have one who's in college now, one a senior in high school, but that ambivalence speaks to me, even reading the book, hearing different families make different arguments about what the priorities ought to be, it does introduce ambivalence. And I guess I'm assuming, just a one sentence answer for me on this, because I want to talk about your next upcoming book for a second, too. I imagine lots of people are reacting with ambivalence to this book.
I mean, I hope it comes across that I don't think there's a right way. I think, these parents are so, people are so set on like, this is the right way, this is the wrong way, this is what it means to be a good parent. I don't see that. I see a lot of different ways to be a good parent, and we should be more respectful of the way other people do things and not be so quick to judge. That's my conclusion.
All right. So I want to set up for the next time we're going to talk to you, because we are going to talk to you again. You've got a book coming out in October that's focused on affirmative action. And of course, the Supreme Court is set up to hear this Harvard case basically again in, 30 seconds. What are you looking for?
I'm hoping that there is a window in which the Supreme Court will allow for some kind of consideration of race, perhaps. It's pretty clear that at the very least, they're going to limit how much you can practice affirmative action and what you need to do in order to be allowed to do so. But my one hope is that they'll say, well, as long as you can prove that there are no other race neutral alternatives, I think it's pretty clear that there aren't from the research that we have on states that have been banned from practicing affirmative action. So, but we'll have to wait and see.
And will you come back in October and talk with us when your new book comes out?
I'd love to.
Because this new book isn't enough. We have to do two. Natasha Waraku is sociology professor at Tufts University. Her latest book right now is called Race at the Top, Asian Americans and Whites in Pursuit of the American Dream in Suburban Schools. Always great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Great to talk to you too, Sienna.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. You know, one of the reasons we love our jobs here at Radio Boston is sometimes we just get to have fun. And we are doing that this week. Throughout many years and several hosts on this show, composer Rob Capello has remained a favorite guest. Capello's best known for his What Makes It Great series, where he takes a well-known song, composer, genre, and breaks it down to unpack why certain works have such lasting power. And it is in a way that is unique and informative and frankly just so cool. So as we end summer and gear up for whatever September holds, we are bringing you three Capello conversations from three hosts. First up today, Mozart. Capello joined host Meghna Chakrabarty in November 2017 to dive into why Mozart's G minor symphony is just so great.
Well, you know, I think this is one of the pieces that I like to pick because everyone knows the beginning. Even if you don't know the title, I mean, let's face it, Symphony No. 40 in G minor is not the world's greatest title. But even if you don't know the title, everyone knows, you know, as a kid, you were told it was, it's a bird, it's a plane, no, it's Mozart, you know, and ruined it for life. But this is an absolutely fantastic piece. Now, I'm going to spend a whole hour on it at Jordan Hall on Sunday, but I'm going to give you a brief précis of what makes this fantastic piece great.
Okay, I'm all ears.
So let's take this beginning. I mean, the beginning is not so great. I mean, this tune, I mean, not that fantastic.
Cell phones have ruined it for me, really.
It's nothing much. I mean, you have it once, you do it again, you do it a third time, then the big news, a leap. Great. So we're going to call this, and I'll now ruin it again for another generation of listeners, do it once, do it twice, and then leap up.
Okay.
So that's our first idea. Do it once, do it twice, and then leap up. Then you got the second half of the idea, which seems like it's totally unrelated. You go down a scale. Three notes down, three notes down, three notes down, down. Okay, sounds totally different, but they actually rhyme. They have the same rhythm. Ba-da-dum, 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 bum. Uh-huh. Same rhythm. Same rhythm as...
Two
different groups of people, Palestinians and Israelis, who seem like they have nothing in common, are actually connected by their fundamental humanity, by the rhythm behind them. So that's our idea. Let's get in our ears. That's our idea. Then we do the whole thing lower, so you get it in your ear. Three notes down, three notes down, three notes down. That's our idea. Now, a million things happen to it, but I just want to show you the amazing possibilities that he hears in this in the middle. So we come to the development section. We come to the middle of this thing where the plot thickens and where we find out what this all means. We come to the ending in the first part. Everything's fine. All of a sudden, we travel. Where are we? Oh, no. Huh? What key are we in? At this moment, we think we will never find a key ever again. We're lost. And suddenly, we think, okay, we're here. It's supposed to go, but instead it goes.
Oh, yeah.
Whoa, now I saw your eyebrows go up. It's working. The eyebrows go up. All right, so that doesn't work. Then we try it lower. That was a great eyebrow. And it should go, but instead it goes. We are still searching for a place, finding a home, okay? Then magic happens. I don't have time to do it. I'll skip it now. You come to Jordan Hall. You shouldn't miss what happens. I'm going to go to the heart of the thing. Okay, this idea is 8 bars long. Ba-da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-2, da-da-3, da-da-da, da-4, da-da-5, ba-da-da, ba-da-6, da-da-7, da-da-dum, ba-da-8. Like Beethoven, he starts looking for the essence of things. Peel away all the inessentials. Let's get to the heart of the story. Mm. Let's get to what the lead is all about. 8 bars get reduced to 4 bars. 4 bars get reduced to 2 bars. 2 bars get reduced to 10 notes. Okay, now our original one was do it once, do it twice, and then leap up. Now we put it into what we would call like its prime form. You reduce it to only 10 notes and just 2 pitches. Just these 2 notes.
Mm-hmm.
10 notes. Once, do it twice, and then no leap. Just do it once, do it twice, and then repeat. This is like the prime form. Okay, violins do it by themselves. Do it once, do it twice, and then repeat. They do it higher. Do it once, do it twice, and then repeat.
Yeah.
The woodwinds reduce it even further. 10 notes is too much. Let's reduce it to just 6 notes. Do it once and then repeat. Do it higher. Do it once and then repeat. They overlap and make a stew out of it, a jambalaya. higher. Search higher. I mean, you're just dying of tension here, right? Then we come to the climax. I skip an amazing moment. Now, question for you, Magna. When I do the opening version.
I really was holding my breath there. Right, the tension is intense.
For 1 second, breathe. Now, okay. When I go like this, do I go down to the second note or up?
I feel you want to go up.
I want to, but it goes down the first time. So,
right.
So okay. We'll call do it once. We'll call it do it down. Okay. What do you think the upside down version of do it down would be?
Should be down.
Do it up. Exactly. Yeah. The whole universe is now reduced to nothing but either do it down or do it up. The first three notes of the symphony, you hear in the strings, they go do it up, do it down, do it down, do it up, do it up, do it up. Do it up, do it up, do it up. All these different versions are the first three notes of the symphony, either right side up or upside.
Yeah.
But best of all, in the cellos and basses, you have the meaning of life right there. What were the first three notes of the symphony? The first three notes were, that's all they play over and over again. Do it once, do it once. So it's like life is happening up here. Do it up, do it down. The meaning of life is there in the cellos, the first three notes of the symphony over and over again. And at this great climax where everything is reduced to its pure cosmic essence, then the strings drop out, the woodwinds do nothing but some version of those three notes. They do it either down, do it down, slide it down, do it down, slide it down, do it down, slide it down, do it down. All versions of the first three notes of the symphony until magically we're back at the beginning. You know, there's that great quote from T.S. Eliot, we shall never cease from exploration, and the goal of all our exploring will be to come back where we started and know the place for the first time. We come back, and after the journey of the piece, we now know the place for the first time.
Fabulous. Absolutely fantastic. Now, Rob, you are walking us through this on your keyboard here, but let's just take a second to listen to an orchestra.
Let's do it with orchestra, and there'll be voiceover from Rob so you don't miss a single item.
All right, go.
This is the opening. Do it once, do it twice, and then leap up. Three notes down, and this is the opening idea.
Yeah.
Let's now skip to that second section where it gets developed. End of first part. We think we know where we are. Transition. Huh? Where are we? Try to find a key, maybe here, okay? Change the end. Do it lower. Change the end again. Third time lower. Now, counterpoint. Four bars long in the bass. Flip the parts up to the violins. Four bars long. Flip it upside down again in the bass. Four bars. Flip one more time. Once, two, three, four. Reduce to just two. One, two. One, two. 10 notes. Once, do it twice, and then repeat. Do it once, do it twice, and then, now just violins. Overlap with the 6-note version. Do it higher. 10 and 6. Higher. Now just 3. Just 3. Just 3. 6. Just 3. Now, here, bass. Do it once. There's the first 3 notes of the symphony, the cellos and basses. Do it once. Transition, just woodwinds. All versions of the first 3 notes. And we are back and know the place for the first time. There you go.
Oh my God.
The mini version of
that
an hour
amazing.
At Jordan Hall. You just got the Reader's Digest. Do we still
amazing.
Have Reader's Digest? I don't know. If we do, that was the Reader's Digest
I want you to be on my perch on my shoulder every time I listen to any piece of music.
I'll diet immediately just to make sure it's not too much on your shoulder.
The fabulous Rob Kaplow. I can't stand that. That was so amazing. Now, so, you know, every time I hear a piece by Mozart, the only question I have is how did he do it? But you just explained how did he do it. But this is a particularly emotional piece.
It is.
What was going on in his life when he wrote it?
You know, it's when you say it's emotional, it's really true. And in fact, one of the things that's so odd about this piece, I mean, in general, classical period symphonies were like happy affairs. They had happy endings. They all ended in major keys. Even Beethoven never wrote a symphony that ended in a minor key. Mm. One of the extraordinary things about this piece is that one of only 2 symphonies of his 41 that's in a minor key, But this one actually ends in a minor key. It refuses that Beethoven victory of light over dark, triumph. It ends with tragedy, grief, and rage. And it was emotional and intense in a way that no other piece was at that time. You know, people can speculate a lot because there's wonderful mystery surrounding this piece. The truth is, nobody knows anything about it. All that people know is he wrote all three of his final symphonies in the sickeningly brief span of 9 weeks in the summer of 1788. No one knows whether he wrote them for any particular occasion, a particular orchestra.
Didn't one of his children die or something at that time?
There was no real death. It would be lovely to say his kids died and then he wrote sad music. But the thing is, Mozart was capable of writing incredibly happy music when his kids were deathly ill, including himself, and also capable of writing really sad music when things were going well. His circumstances in life were quite bad at this point. Particular point in time, and he was losing money, he was losing popularity, he was no longer the hit Justin Bieber of his day. But you know, it's just an amazing mystery. No one really knows what it was written for or what the circumstances were.
Now, you said one of just two minor symphonies.
Yeah, there's another one called the Little G Minor Symphony because it's worse and it's earlier. But this is the major one. But none of them ending in a minor key was really a repudiation of the whole. I mean, you went to art, in other words, to not think about the horrible issues of the day. Yeah. They all ended in major keys. That's a really important fact. They all had upbeat, happy Disney endings, but not this one. And it refuses. And one of the things that we'll do in that program in Jordan is I'll show you all these major key ideas, but they come back in minor. So it's like you have this brief moment of hope and happiness when you first hear them, but then when they come back, it's all tragedy, grief, and rage. And I think that's one of the great things about Mozart is I often say that it's not about being, it's about becoming. Mm. In other words, when you hear this, it's nothing. We have no idea what it's going to be. It's not what it is when you first hear it. It's what it's going to become over the course of the piece. And that mini journey we took, that's what makes great classical music great. Yeah. Not what the idea is, but the possibilities that we can see hidden in it that no one else would see.
You know, whenever you come and you talk with us and you do your performances in Boston, I always feel like my eyes are being opened to a piece for the first time. How do you do this, Rob? I mean, do you just sit down with a great piece of music and you just like start note by note?
Well, you know, I think what it's really all about, and I often think it's not even about music, it's about paying attention.
Yeah.
You know, it's about learning how to listen. You know, you say your eyes are opening, but I'm also hoping that your ears are opening in the same, although it's a lot easier visual
but
to
metaphorical
see your
eyes.
Yeah, but you know, but I do think it's about learning to pay attention. It's all right there in front of us, only we're not used to really listening. Whether it's a piece of great poetry, a piece of great literature, or a piece of great music. You know, my first book is entitled All You Have to Do Is Listen. And I think that that's really true, except listening is anything but all you have to do. It's a really complex process. So for me, I just sit and listen and try to notice what's there, try to hear what the composer is doing, because really, in a sense, all composition is about is listening for possibilities.
Yeah.
You have an idea and you think, what's possible? What could I create out of this? You know, Ezra Pound says, genius is the capacity to see 10 things where the ordinary man sees one.
Mm.
I mean, an ordinary Salieri would not have heard all the possibilities Mozart does. So mostly what I do is I sit and I listen and then try to share what I've listened with all of you and hopefully all the people who come to Jordan Hall.
That's musician, composer, and author Rob Capello talking with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty in 2017. And while the show at Jordan Hall has long since ended, his musical breakdowns live on. Tomorrow, he'll introduce host Deborah Becker to the wonders of Leonard Bernstein. And let's go out today with a little more of Mozart's Symphony No. 40 in G minor. This is the Boston Symphony Orchestra, led by then-conductor Leonard Bernstein.